The Patterns of Piety.
This is Dialogue, an introduction into the most important dialogues and conversations of Imam Ali ibn Muhammad al-Hadi alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. This is Dialogue. I'm your host Mahdi. Imam Ali ibn Muhammad al-Hadi alayhi salam was a pure source of wisdom and knowledge. Despite his young age, he showed what divinely gifted knowledge really looks like. Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Messenger of Allah, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household. Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam was also the 10th divinely appointed Imam, and he was the 10th divinely appointed successor of the Messenger of Allah, peace and blessings upon him. Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam was also the son of the 9th divinely appointed Imam, Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam. After Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam answered with the answers of an expert the most difficult of questions posed to him by the Shia scholars and jurisprudents, the Shia leaders at that time had more faith and certainty now of what they had previously believed, that a divinely appointed Imam must have the most knowledge, and he must be the most knowledgeable one of his time, regardless of whether he is young or old. And so the knowledge, virtue, and the delving into the sciences of the Holy Quran and the Sunnah of Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam astonished the minds and sparked meetings and gatherings in all parts of the Muslim world. At this moment, we invite you to listen to parts of the Arabic text of Ziyarat Jamiatul Kabira by Imam Hadi alayhi salam, along with its English translation. Please stay tuned.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام على أئمة الهدى ومصابيح التجا وأعلام التقى وذوي النهى.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Peace be upon the directors of right guidance, the lanterns in darkness, the patterns of piety, the owners of understanding, the endued with thoughts, the havens of the peoples, the inheritors of the prophets, the perfect specimen, the most excellent call in the arguments of Allah against the inhabitants of the world, the hereafter and the former world. Allah's mercy and blessings too be upon you all.
Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Peace be upon the exponents of the recognition of Allah, the centers of Allah's blessing, the essence of Allah's wisdom, the keepers of Allah's secrets, the bearers of Allah's book, the successor of Allah's prophet, and the progeny of Allah's messenger. May Allah send blessings upon him and his household. Allah's mercy and blessings too be upon them.
Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. As-salamu ala al-a'immat ad-du'at.
Peace be upon the imams, the leaders, the guides, the chiefs, the authorities, the defenders, the protectors, the people of the reminder, the men in authority, the left ones by Allah, his select, his party, the case of his knowledge, his argument, his path, his light, his proof. Allah's mercy and blessings too be upon them.
Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we are talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Hadi, alayhi salam, the 10th divinely appointed Imam from the household of the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. Now, one of the things that was very prevalent in the time of Imam al-Hadi, alayhi salam, it was something that, you know, people were confused about, specifically the religious scholars and the ulama of the Ahlul Sunnah, especially because they were disconnected from the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam to a certain extent. They were confused about certain things such as compulsion and free will. And so one of the things that they were really stuck in was this idea of compulsion and free will. What's interesting is in this conversation, of course, which is a long conversation, we find that Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam, he starts to bring up various verses of the Holy Quran in which His Eminence talks about how Allah will punish the disbelievers, He will punish the kuffar, He will punish those who commit sins. Because Allah told these people to not commit these different offenses, yet they went ahead and they committed those offenses, and so now they are liable for punishment. Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam talks about compulsion, and he talks about how, you know, if Allah is going to punish these individuals, then He cannot force these people into committing sins, because this would, you know, eventually mean that Allah is unjust and Allah is oppressive, because He is punishing people for sins that they were forced into doing. You know, and really it doesn't make any kind of a sense. So Imam al-Hadi, he talks about verses of the Holy Quran, and eventually he kind of closes off this whole idea of absolute compulsion, again by listing some verses of the Holy Quran. Eventually he says that we, the Ahlul Bayt, alayhim as-salam, say that Allah the Almighty rewards people for their doings and punish them for their doings that they do with their own will and ability that Allah has given to them. Allah has enjoined the people to do some things, and He has forbidden people from doing other things. That things which Allah has enjoined the people to do, when the people do it out of their free will, they are rewarded for these things, and this is just and honorable on the behalf of Allah the Almighty. And on the other hand, when the people prevent themselves from doing those things which Allah has forbidden them from doing, then again Allah rewards that individual, because out of their free will they prevented themselves from doing those things which Allah had forbidden them from doing. But on the other hand, if the individual goes ahead and does those things which Allah has prohibited, then of course they are liable for punishment. And Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam again brings up a verse from the Holy Quran talking about the mercy and the justness and the compassion of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, where the Holy Quran says, whoever brings forth a good deed, we shall reward them with 10 of that like. But whoever brings an evil deed, we shall recompense them with the like of that one deed, and no one shall be dealt with unjustly. And finally, he, Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam, talks about how every soul shall be rewarded for what they have earned, and no justice shall be done to them on the day of justice and the day of judgment. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/EN Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many other great programs as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
It's April 17, 1917. British forces launched their invasion to capture Palestine, still part of the Ottoman Empire. The battle goes on for 3 days. The casualties on the British side are mounting. They have to retreat. London then recruits Arab tribes, promising to help them shake off the yoke of the Ottomans. With their assistance, the British raid and destroy Ottoman supply lines and logistics in the Palestine region. On the first day of November 1917, the British forces mount a new round of invasion on Gaza. Lack of ammunition and supply cripple Ottoman defense line. Gaza falls into the hands of the British, and by December 1917, they take Al-Quds, but never honor their promise. Instead, the British occupy Palestine until 1948, when they hand over the Holy Land to the Jews, flooding in from across the world. The Palestinian plight and the struggle for liberation begins. On May 14, 1948, General Alan Cunningham, the last British High Commissioner, left what was known then as the Mandate of Palestine. John Marlowe wrote of the last few minutes of British rule in his book, The Seat of Pilate. The Union Jack was lowered, and with the speed of an execution and the silence of a ship that passes in the night, British rule in Palestine came to an end. On the same day, David Ben-Gurion announced the establishment of Israel. It came as a shock to the Arab world. Several Arab countries joined forces to expel the insolent newcomers, but faced a crushing defeat. A neo-colonial project, Israel systematically took over Palestinian lands, expelling people from their homes and leaving many to live as refugees in isolated enclaves. Official records conservatively estimate that back then, at least 750,000 Palestinians were forcibly removed from their homes and lands by Israeli forces, resulting in the capture of 78% of historic Palestine. The remaining 22% was divided into the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. The displaced Palestinians entered a state of diaspora, with many spending the rest of their lives in refugee camps. In addition to the conquest of major cities, approximately 530 Palestinian villages were destroyed, and around 15,000 Palestinians lost their lives in a series of large-scale atrocities. Crushed and crestfallen, the Arabs vowed to wreak revenge, take their stolen lands back, and restore their lost pride, honor, and glory. With the rise of Pan-Arabic Gamal Abdel Nasser, hope and enthusiasm came back among the Arabs. A coalition of Arab states was formed to go to war with Israel on June 5, 1967. This time around, Israel overwhelmed the coalition in less than a week. The decisive victory included the capture of the Sinai Peninsula, the Gaza Strip, the West Bank, the old city of Al-Quds, and the Golan Heights. The Arab countries' losses in the conflict were disastrous. Egypt's casualties numbered more than 11,000, with 6,000 for Jordan and 1,000 for Syria, compared with only 700 for Israel. The Arab armies also suffered crippling losses of weaponry and equipment. The Six-Day War also created hundreds of thousands of refugees and brought more than 1 million Palestinians in the occupied territories under Israeli rule. The defeat demoralized both the Arab public and the political elite. Pan-Arabism was defanged and hopes to take back Palestine were shattered. The Palestinian issue remained unresolved as an Arab problem. Israeli Prime Minister Golda Meir famously claimed in an interview with the Sunday Times on June 15, 1969, that there were no such things as Palestinians. They didn't exist. Almost a decade later, in 1978, Egyptian President Anwar Sadat and Israeli Prime Minister Menachem Begin signed the Camp David Accords, according to which Egypt would recognize Israel as a legitimate state. A stab in the back of Palestine. Betrayed by Egypt and abandoned by the rest of the Arab world, the Palestinian nation was withering away under the illegal, brutal occupation. Two countries away from Palestine, the Iranian people were making history by toppling the powerful regime of Mohammad Reza Shah, who, like the Israelis, had the United States on his side. The fall of the Shah, who had the biggest army in the Middle East and the fifth greatest one in the world, rekindled hopes in the hearts of the Palestinians. The invincible could be vincible. In the words of the co-founder of Hamas, Abdelaziz Al-Rantisi, we believe that the Islamic Revolution of Iran has had a positive impact on other Muslim countries. It has awakened them, and I believe this awakening accounts for uprisings across the Muslim world. The newly established Islamic Republic was, however, more than a role model for the Palestinian nation. Iran ended its alliance with Israel overnight, in favor of the Palestinians. Just 6 days after the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979, the Palestine Liberation Organization chief Yasser Arafat led a 58-member delegation to Tehran. As the first official foreign politician to visit Iran, Arafat was warmly received by thousands of Iranians chanting in support of Palestine. When someone goes to their home, they do not need permission, Arafat told the public during his visit to Tehran. He declared, "Iran's revolution is a great victory for Palestine. when I entered Iran's airspace, I felt like I entered the airspace of Beit al-Muqaddas. Tehran turned the Israeli embassy to the Palestinian embassy and renamed the road in front of it to Palestine Street, an act of symbolic importance. At the same time, founder of the Islamic Revolution, Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Ruhollah Khomeini, designated the last Friday of the holy month of Ramadan as Quds Day, calling on all Muslims across the world to mark the day annually in solidarity with the downtrodden people of Palestine. It was a message to the whole world. Palestine is not just an Arab problem. With this spiritual assistance from the charismatic leader of the revolution, Palestine was saved from oblivion. The Palestinian plight came to the foreground, a new lease of life for Palestinian fighters to keep on their uphill battle against the occupiers. The two major Palestinian resistance groups, i.e. the Palestinian Islamic Jihad Movement, PIJ, and Hamas, officially announced their existence in the 1980s. As an underground movement, Islamic Jihad had been found in the late 1970s by Fathi Shaghari, a young physician and a Gaza refugee. Endorsing the Islamic Revolution of Iran, Shaghari said, "This revolution was a wake-up call to us all that our victory is contingent upon following Imam Khomeini's path. So it behooves us to avoid all other ways except the way shown by the Imam in our fight against the occupation regime of Israel." Tehran's ties with the Palestinian resistance groups developed steadily, even when the Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein waged one of the bloodiest and longest wars in the region against Iran. Iran's closer cooperation with the Palestinian groups began in 1987 after Israel expelled Hamas and Islamic Jihad leaders to Lebanon as part of its efforts to suppress the Palestinian national leadership in the occupied Gaza Strip and the West Bank. The raging war against Iran failed to distract the nation from the Palestinian cause. The Islamic Republic expressed its deep disagreements over the so-called Reagan peace plan and the Fahd peace plan, where the rights of the Palestinians had been almost totally ignored in favor of the Israeli regime. Inspired partly by the Islamic Revolution, in December 1987, the Palestinian people staged a sustained series of protests, civil disobedience, and riots, which later came to be known as the First Intifada, or the Stone Intifada, as they were still throwing stones at Israeli soldiers who were armed to the teeth. Amid the deafening silence of Arab leaders, Tehran lent all its support to the Palestinian cause. Imam Khomeini took a clear, strong stance, saying with the Israeli regime in place, the Palestinians would not see the end of their sufferings. In 1993, Fathi Shaghari told Newsday, "Iran gives us money and supports us. Then we supply the money and arms to the occupied territories and support the families of our people." To draw further attention to the pain and suffering of the Palestinian people, a couple of years after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, Iranian pilgrims began staging demonstrations against Israel and its major supporter, the United States, at the Hajj. Perhaps one thing that sparked the flames of the First Intifada was a tragic incident that happened that year in Mecca, Saudi Arabia. On July 31, 1987, during one of these pro-Palestinian demonstrations, the clash between Iranian demonstrators and Saudi security forces turned bloody, resulting in the deaths of more than 400 pilgrims. Hamas, an acronym in Arabic for Islamic Resistance Movement, emerged out of the First Palestinian Intifada in 1987. It was co-founded by Sheikh Ahmed Yassin and six others, originally as a local offshoot of Egypt's Muslim Brotherhood. On May 2, 1998, Hamas, still a fledgling group with less than a decade since its formation, paid a visit to Tehran to meet the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. The meeting happened when almost none of the leaders of the Arab world took the Palestinian Intifada seriously. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, however, had a different opinion about the struggle, the group, and its leader, Sheikh Ahmad Yassin. Iran pledged financial support and provided the group with advanced military training at bases belonging to the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps in Iran and Lebanon. It also trained Palestinian engineers to manufacture weapons locally. The Second Palestinian Intifada erupted in September 2000, after the collapse of the so-called Middle East peace talks at Camp David and Ariel Sharon's unlawful visit to Haram al-Sharif, the home of the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the third holiest site in Islam. It was a major uprising by the Palestinians against the Israeli occupation that continued for 5 years. In 2006, Hamas won a huge majority in parliamentary elections, with Palestinian voters giving the group 76 seats in parliament out of the 132 seats available. After the Hamas victory, Khalid Mash'al visited Tehran and said, "Just as Islamic Iran defends the rights of the Palestinians, we defend the rights of Islamic Iran. We are part of a united front against the enemies of Islam." Unlike some other Palestinian groups, Hamas never recognized the occupation regime. So following the group's takeover of Gaza, a crippling blockade was imposed on the Strip to limit the movement of the people and goods, a collective punishment for electing an uncompromising group. To put more pressure, the U.S. and its allies imposed sanctions on Hamas and the community the group represented. Many in the Arab world left the group high and dry, but the Islamic Republic, an all-weather friend, never withdrew its support for the group in the hardest of times. The Shia state gave a hand to the Sunni group to remind the Muslim world that Palestine transcends sectarian differences. On March 9, 2008, a Hamas senior commander, interviewed by the Sunday Times, said 300 of the group's best brains had been secretly sent to Tehran. According to the commander, who wished to remain anonymous, half are still being trained by the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. They're learning how to make explosives from everyday items and produce more effective rockets. The rest have already returned from the IRGC base in Tehran. Some have been trained as snipers. Others have learned to use tunnels in attacks on Israeli forces. Iran is our mother. She gives us information, military supplies, and financial support. The resistance movement in Palestine built up steam when Lieutenant General Haj Qasem Soleimani took the helm of Iran's Quds Force, one of the IRGC's branches with its main focus on assisting resistance groups in the region. Thanks to Tehran's unwavering support, resistance groups in Palestine grew strong enough to deal the hardest blows on the Israeli regime, something unimaginable after the Six-Day War. For the Palestinians, time for lopsided defeat had gone, and for the Israelis, victory was no longer for granted. Subsequent wars like the one in 2012 left no doubt that the Palestinians had risen from the ashes. During a visit by Hamas leaders to Iran in 2019, Ayatollah Khamenei stated, "Not many years ago, the Palestinians fought against Israel with stones. But today, instead of stones, they're equipped with precision missiles. This signifies development." Struggle against the occupation regime reached its crescendo in October 7th, 2023. when Hamas forces launched a land, air, and sea attack into the heart of the Israeli occupation territories, catching the enemy off guard and shattering its myth of invincibility in spite of all its state-of-the-art weapons and its huge military expenditure. Iran was not involved in the attack, but who can deny the country's decades-long support that molded drone flyers out of the stone-throwing fighters?
Sheikh Baqir Sharif Al-Qarashi decides to compile.
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosrow Shahi.
Shahid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr. He was born in Qadamiya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Shahrudi was.
When we say Divan of Hafiz is a book of Irfan,
Maulavi claims that this Masnavi Ma'navi is the interpretation of the Quran.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Very welcome to another episode of the program, The Teacher, an introduction into the religious and scholarly lives of the most outstanding Muslim, Shiite dignitaries, personalities, ulama, and scholars during the history of Islam. I am Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers, two Islamic scholars from the Islamic House of Qom, Shaykh Rouhani and Shaykh Fadai. Shaykh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
And Shaykh Fadai, assalamu alaikum to you.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi.
All right, for today's discussion, we want to talk about one of the fuqaha of the 13th century Hijra, one of the most outstanding students of Muhammad Hassan al-Najafi and Sheikh al-Ansari, Mirza Habibullah Rashdi. He was famous for nurturing so many outstanding students of the houses of Najaf and Iraq. Sheikh Rouhani, let's start with you, brother. Give us some details about the early life of Mirza Habibullah Rashdi.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. About Mirza Habibullah Rashdi's biography, what we can mention here is that his father was Mirza Muhammad Ali Khan, son of Jahangir Khan Qochani Gilani, one of the most famous Shia scholars in his time. So his ancestors were originally from Qochan, who were forced to move to Gilan in early 7th, century. And he was born in 1234, and of course in one of the villages of Gilan, which is a province in northern part of nowadays Iran.
Yes.
And he passed away in Jumada Thani in 1312, and of course then in Najaf al-Ashraf, and was buried in one of the rooms around the courtyard of the holy shrine of Amir al-Mu'minin, Imam Ali alayhi salatu wassalam.
That's right. Sheikh Fadai, now the major question is that so many of the outstanding scholars of Islam, especially the Shiite ulama and fuqaha, left their hometown in order to migrate to another country, Iraq, on that time, especially the cities of Najaf, Samarra, and Karbala, in order to attend the courses of outstanding scholars over there. It seems to be a very hard travel and difficult travel, especially on that time, without facilities. What motivations do you think they had to do so?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. We can say that the main difference between religious knowledge and non-religious knowledge is that in religious knowledge, the scholar feel a very deep responsibility.
Yes.
But usually in non-religious knowledge, people and the scientists think about themselves more than the others. Of course, they benefit other people as well. But the main focus is on themselves in order to improve, in order to gain some wealth, to have a good life, and beside that, to help some people as well. But when people enter the sphere of religious knowledge, they think about other people more than themselves.
Yes.
When you feel this deep responsibility, we can say that you pass from yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You can tolerate every difficulties.
Yes.
Our scholars were like that.
Mm-hmm.
When they felt this responsibility that we as the scholars of religion have to teach this religion and
yes.
preach this religion, so we have to tolerate a lot of difficulties. One of the difficulties was that migration. As you mentioned, this migration was not easy. At that time, for example, moving from Rasht or Gilan, as we call
yes.
it, the province, Iranian province,
yes.
to other country like Iraq
yes.
By, I don't know, horse and camels.
Yes.
And even...
Unfeed him.
Sometimes right. unfeed.
Okay. Yes.
Usually with their families,
okay.
with their wives, with their children.
Yes.
And among a lot of diseases.
Wow.
Among a lot of thieves
yes.
in the ways.
Yes.
You know, they had to pay a lot. They had to spend a lot of time. Maybe
yes.
these migration spent for 6 months or 1 year
yes.
to go to...
They were on the way to go to Najaf yes. or Karbala. That's
but,
right.
You know, okay. now we just read in the books that they migrated from this country to that country. That's
okay.
it.
Okay.
But it is not like that.
Yes.
They, I want to say that they felt their responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
Because of that... they did that. For example, if you check the teachers and the students
yes.
of these great scholars, Mirza Habibullah Rashti,
yes.
you can see that this chain of scholars, these are the famous ones that even now in our Hoza we are benefiting from them, we are using from their knowledge.
Yes.
What is the common point?
Mm-hmm.
The common point is that responsibility.
That's right.
From professor and teacher to the students, again from that students as a teacher to his student, they transfer this responsibility. For example, Muhammad Hassan Najafi, nowadays in Hoza we call it Sahib Jawahir.
Yes.
And Sheikh Ansari.
They were the teachers.
Yes. The authors of Rasail
right.
and Makasib.
Yes, yes.
You know, Jawahir, Rasail and Makasib are the main
yes.
books,
yes.
textbooks in Hausa. These are his professors and
mm-hmm.
teachers. And then about his student, Sayyid Muhammad Kazim Yazdi. We know it as Sahib Urve.
Yes.
Aghaziya Araghi, Mirza Naini.
Yes.
You know, this is a chain.
Yes.
They are the, I can say, the scholars that felt that responsibility
uh-huh. okay.
and tolerated all the difficulties in order to transfer that legacy of religion to us. And nowadays, we are using that legacy because
yes.
of their
okay.
hard working.
That's right.
And that.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
And Shaykh Rouhani, when we look at their personal individual life, we can find them very much humble.
the people who never were after reputation or something. For example, they say that Mirza Hibullah Rashti was among the best students of Sheikh Al-Ansari, but after the demise of the Sheikh, he never accepted the position of Marja'iyah or Za'ama, as better say, custodianship and guardianship of the houses, and referred the people to Mirza Shirazi on that time. Let's talk a little bit about this aspect of the religious personal life, Sheikh.
Yes, about the, let's say, moral characteristics of this great scholar, there are many points that could be mentioned. One of these that is that his special moral characteristic made him a very pious kind of personality.
Yes.
Who was famous for his asceticism.
Yes.
He always remembered Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and seized any opportunities to recite the Holy Quran or prayers and supplications. And he was so careful and cautious that he could not easily answer the questions that he was asked without complete research. And he was so respectful toward Mirza Shirazi that he encouraged people to ask their question from him and to be his followers, muqallid, not muqallid of his own self,
yes,
muqallid of this Sayyid. As Mirza Shirazi, I mean.
Yes.
Although he was the top student of Sheikh Al-Ansari, but of course, as you rightly mentioned, after his demise, he did not take, let's say, Shari'i funds, I mean, khums or wujuhat,
yes,
and okay, never actually showed the slightest desire to become marja taqlid, even when his student insisted on his becoming a marja, but yes, he actually directed them towards Mirza Shirazi.
You mean he was the marja, but he was
he
not
was, yeah, he was already
accepting
the marja, he did not
yes, official position of the custodianship of the Hawza on that time.
Yeah, of course.
Yes.
There were lots of these kind of scholars, even Shaykh even Sayyid Ibn Tawus, rahmatullah alayhi, was also the same,
yes,
that he did not answer the fiqhi questions.
Yes. Uh-huh.
He also tried in his life not to interfere to any kind of fiqhi or jurisprudential uh-huh kind of
okay
issues.
That's right.
Because not becoming a marja'i taqlid. So the same case is with this great scholar.
That's right.
This is the moral kind of characteristics of many of the Shia scholars that could give us lots of lessons,
mm-hmm,
particularly the students of Hawza and the ulama of this modern time.
That's right.
Of the Shayu, yes.
And one of the interesting points about the life of Mirza Hibullah Rashti is compiling a kind of book typically known as Hashiya, or the marginal notes or explanations to great books of his masters, Sheikh Al-Ansari and Muhammad Hassan Al-Najafi. Badayu Al-Afkar, which is a Hashiya on Najat al-Abad of Sahib al-Jawahir, is one of them. So what was the need to write such explanations or marginal notes to great books of the teachers, Sheikh Fadai?
You know, in the system of Hausa, it was like that you go to the classes of a professor,
mm-hmm,
you use from him, but you never stop. You don't want to just imitate what he said. You don't want to just stay at that level.
Yes.
They always try to improve the borders of knowledge.
Yes.
You know, Hashiya or marginal notes,
yes,
has two aspects. The first aspect is to explain what the teacher said.
Okay.
Why? For example, we say that he was one of the top students of Sheikh Al-Ansari or
yes
Muhammad Hassan Najafi. So he could understand what his teacher Sheikh Ansari said better than us,
uh-huh,
and even better than the other students at that time.
Okay.
First of all, he wanted, and not just he, Habibullah Rashti, as I told you, in the system of Hawza, it was like that, and even now it is like that. First of all, they want to explain what the professor said at the class.
Yes.
In order to stop and prevent misunderstanding from the lessons of the professor. The other aspect is to improve the border of knowledge. Maybe after reaching the level of ijtihad, especially after this level, maybe the student doesn't accept some of the ideas and theories of the teacher.
Uh-huh.
So they never were like that to copy all the theories of
yes
the teacher.
Okay.
For example, in our Hawza, we have Ayatollah Jawadi as one of the great mufassirs, the students of Allama Tabatabai.
Yes.
You know, people who don't know about these two great scholars think that so Ayatollah Jawadi is a student of Allama Tabatabai and he copied all the theories of Allama Tabatabai.
Yes.
But if you go to his lessons, for example, what I did,
yes.
When you go to his lessons for several years, you can understand that he has various different ideas.
Uh-huh.
So marginal notes, one of the aspects of marginal notes is,
or
that
it's better to say he adds some new perspectives,
yes, yes,
to the old, for example,
as I said,
materials.
Improving the borders of knowledge.
Yes.
A good student never main a copier.
Yes.
Never main an imitator.
Yes, yes.
This is the science.
Yes.
And it is interesting that we can see in the history that in the age of 25, he reached the level of ijtihad. You know, ijtihad is not something easy.
Yes.
If we want to compare with the degrees of our knowledges in universities nowadays, at least ijtihad is a combination of 10 doctorates.
Yes.
At least.
Okay.
In the, ilm of fiqh, usul, rijal, diraye, I don't know, philosophy, and in ilm al-hadith, a lot different. He should be a master at least in 10 field of studies. In which age? In the age of 25.
Yes.
You know, our scholars were genius once.
Yes.
And why? Because they tried a lot.
Yes.
You know, they never thought about, I don't know, how much income I have. And nowadays in Hosea University, if we want to study, first of all, we think about income.
Mm-hmm.
If we want to study, how much can I get? If I cannot have a good life,
yes,
I would leave these studies.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, our legacy of Hosea was not like that.
Yes, okay, that's right. Thank you very much. Sheikh Rouhani, anything missed?
Not actually. The points mentioned regarding this great scholar, yes.
Okay, thank you very much for a nice elaboration regarding the life of Mirza Habibullah Rashdi. He passed away on Jamadi al-Sani 14th. It was Thursday, 13-12, in the city of Najaf at the age of 78. His body was taken into one of the we can say chambers or rooms around the holy tomb of Imam Ali alayhi salam, and he was buried in the holy courtyard of Imam Ali alayhi salam in the city of Najaf. May Allah bless the soul of this outstanding man. May Allah protect the following generations of the scholars who still are busy with nurturing students all across the Islamic houses around the world. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program The Teacher. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Reality. It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, lovely friends from all around the world. Welcome back to a new episode of Back to Reality. This is IRIB English Radio. Once more, I have the honor to be your host. This is Asma, and here with me I have two very dear guests, Sister Bita.
Yeah.
And Zahra.
and Sister Zahra. Well, assalamu alaikum, both of you.
Alaykum assalam, dear.
And you know the ritual. You have to introduce yourself very much briefly. Tell us about your background and let us know you more.
I'm Zahra and I'm a computer science student. I also attend HOSA and have finished my second stage studies in HOSA and I'm completing my degree in computer science.
So that's very good. Wish you best of luck.
I'm Bita, by the way, and it's a pleasure for me to be here again. I'm studying medical science, and that's it.
Yeah, thank you for being
You're
here,
welcome.
Both of you. I do believe that anyone's priority would define those individuals, like as in, tell me your priorities, and then I would judge you based on them. And I think most of the time that comes out to be true. Because the way you prioritize everything in your life would make it clear what kind of a person you are. Like, there are many psychological tests that would ask you some weird question. And then out of those weird questions, they come out to figure out, okay, you put your family first, and then you put your friends next, and then your loved one, and then whatever, you know, things like that.
It really affects how you, like, manage your entire life.
Exactly, yeah.
How you end up growing, how you who you interact with, who you end up, what skills you gain.
Exactly. And it is clear ever since you are born, ever since you are studying to interact with other human beings, like from the very young age when you are going to pick your priorities, it's very much telling about your personality.
Yeah, and I believe the most difficult choices are the one that you are choosing something that you love over something that you love. And at those times, priority is the key to help you. And I believe the first priority that we have to choose is the priority of ourselves or other people over ourselves.
Other people over ourselves.
You guess, but most of the people, at least at this era of individualism.
That's a very difficult question.
Yeah, it is. Because we're living in a world that your benefit is the priority. If I benefit from this communication, then it's okay. We're going to go communicate with each
that's
other.
That's so sad.
Yeah. It is. And if it's so not, then that's the end here.
Then we have no relation.
Yeah. It is so sad, but it's the brutal fact of our modern era.
Mm-hmm. How do you define these priorities in life? What kind of priorities we must have in our life?
Obviously, there are priorities in terms of, like, usually priorities end up showing themselves in our time management. Mm-hmm. In what, how much time we spend on what. Like, if our priority is, like, work, usually you'll see you end up spending, like, 8 days, 8 hours a day on work, 6 days a week, work overtime. Maybe somebody's priority is money. Maybe somebody's priority is social status. And those priorities end up defining that this person, how they spend their time, who they interact with.
Yeah.
For example, like, you know, somebody works a lot.
What is your priority in life? That's a personal question, though.
Self-growth, family.
Family and self-growth.
Yeah.
And you, Sister Vita?
Actually, it was a phase for me that I thought that I can do everything I want. I can achieve everything I want. And I want to learn the literature at the same time with studying medicine. Then it would be something, okay, I have the time. I will sacrifice other things for that. But it's impossible. Our time is limited, so we have to prioritize. And this is an obligation. This is not something to choose. I mean, because most of the people think, okay, if you want to be organized and successful, you can have priorities. It's not like that. You have to have priorities.
You're a human being.
Yeah.
You are restricted.
You
have boundaries.
Restricted.
There is time.
Exactly.
There is your health and your body. Everything must be on a moderate scale.
And my priority is not to be regretful about the things that I did during the limited time I have in this life.
That's very nice.
Yeah. Nice. And it's a bit difficult sometimes because mm-hmm. I don't know what will I regret in the future. For example, if I have fun at the time, it's okay. In the future, I have a lot of memories. I have a lot of beautiful things to narrate for my children. But if I do that, I will lose another thing, another part.
Exactly.
And
so that's about life.
It is.
Your priorities are going to determine who you are. So we keep it in here. We go for change of mood, for a short break, and then we'll be back.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
So when we talk about priority, as you just mentioned, there's always time management that comes in our mind.
Yeah.
And I guess about that, there are many people who need to learn things. Like one of those people is actually here in front of you.
Me too.
I'm the one person who feel like I always lack this talent to set a plan for myself.
Yeah, managing priorities.
I do, but I cannot stick to it.
And it's hard because a lot of times the things you need to do conflict with one another.
Like, exactly.
You do need to eat food, so you need to make food.
Exactly.
But you also need to study.
Yeah.
But you also need to...
I need to rest, but I also have to get more sleep.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, that's the whole point.
Yeah, that is like a very common, I think, three-way thing right now. The sleep versus study.
Since it's the exam season and everybody's suffering, so I can't. Yeah. I think everybody can relate to that.
Yeah, so I think one, there are many different kind of time management, priority management systems. One of them that I had recently seen was whether something was urgent or not and whether it was important or not.
So, how to differentiate between urgent and important?
Well, I guess urgent is time sensitive. Like, the fact that you need to eat food is urgent. Like, you need to eat food, you're going to die. But, like, something that's important means
important,
but it's not right now.
Exactly.
So, like, you know, or like maybe something even more pressing, like urgent, you need to drink water.
So the penny is dropped now.
Yeah, yeah. If something is unimportant, but it's urgent, try to delegate it. See who else can do it for you. Like, okay, urgently, there are guests coming over. The house needs to be clean. But I also have an exam tomorrow.
Oh, my God.
Do I have a young sibling who I can give the broom to?
Who I can exploit.
Yeah, and I can be like, okay, can you do this today because I have something urgent and important?
And the answer is no, for sure.
Well, yeah, you try to find someone who will accept your delegation.
Yeah.
On the other hand, there are things that are not urgent, but they're important. Like, say you have, like, a very important goal. You want to get your degree. You want to... like finish studying
an
important book.
Yeah.
That you should decide for it. So schedule a time to do it.
It was a nice method.
Yeah.
But, the foundation of this method is that you don't have enough choices. You don't have enough time. Your resource is limited.
Yeah.
So you have to prioritize. But I believe the root and the underlying problem of the new generation is that they have a lot of choices. They have a lot of time. And because of that, they have to prioritize. I mean, it's not the controversial issues of lacking something. It's about having it too much. And because of that, we need to prioritize.
That's why we come with the concept of urgent and important.
Yeah. And the concept of deleting things from your list is really important. Because when
I love that part.
Thank you.
It's never going to happen. But.
Yeah. I do it so much. I delete things forever.
Even in some vital domain like medicine, there is a 40 rule disease. This 40 rule disease tells you that as a doctor, you need to know the common diagnosis of common diseases that are around 40 diseases. If you know all the things about these 40 diseases and you go through, for example, an emergency room for 24 hours, you will actually be 95% correct in your diagnosis of all the patients.
Okay, so that's your secret.
Yeah, this is something like that. So the point is, when there is something common in your life, you tend to ignore it. And this commonness will lead you to ignorance, unfortunately. Yeah. And it happens a lot for human beings. And that's why we have to prioritize. But unfortunately, this mistake will be in your way that you may think priorities are for the times that you are going through difficult phases, you are going through some uncommon accidents in your life.
Yeah.
But it's not like that.
No. On an everyday basis, we also have to.
Priorities.
On a daily basis, we also have to go for priority.
Exactly.
Like
priorities
about in your break time, in your off time.
Yeah.
Yeah, speaking of break, we have to go for a break. Thank you for reminding me.
You caught it.
back to Reality It Is. This is the last word of today's episode. Sister Bita and Sister Zahra have told me a lot. I'm still handling the information. Well, the urgent and important are going to do a lot into my life from now on. So the deleting part, I loved it so much. And then you were talking about knowing about the 40 disease. And if you know all those 40s, then